And we're holding on page Samach Vav in Nedarim Ois Lamed Gimel. We learned yesterday about Rabbi Yehuda was very, very poor and didn't have much hana from this world. So now the Gemara continues about another great tzaddik who was also very poor earlier in his life. Rabbi Akiva, the famous story of Rabbi Akiva, which we had with the number of variations in Masechta Ksuvos. So the Gemara tells Rabbi Akiva ikadshus lebrate de bar Kalva Savua. The daughter of Kalva Savua was mekudesh to Rabbi Akiva. We had in Ksuvos, we had more detail about it, that she saw that he was Sanuo Mali, that he has great good midas, even though he was an Amoret. Shama bar Kalva Savua, Abraham Namikol Nichse, by Kalva Savua heard about it and made a neder barring her from having any hana from any of his nechosim. To pressure her into divorcing him. Nevertheless, that didn't put her off. She went and married Rabbi Akiva in the winter time. And now where they didn't have a good place to sleep, so they were sleeping in a barn full of straw. And Rabbi Akiva was having to pick straw out of the hair. Now, the gears that we have in front of us, mankit le tivna min mazye, means that he would have to be picking out straw out of his own hair. And that's how you have the way we have the Ran printed in front of us here is as well, but the way it's printed in the Gemara is actually that he was picking it out of her hair. Whatever the case, straw was getting stuck in her hair, in his hair, and they were having to pick it out. Omala, so he says to her, Ihavoi li, if only I had the ability to, Raminaloch Yerushalayim de Dava, I would place on you a Yerushalayim of gold. We find in Masechta Shabbos, there's such a takshit mentioned, Yerushalayim Irshal Zahav, the Mishnah mentions, it's a golden ornament of some kind that had an image, that had a depiction of Yerushalayim on it. Rashi in Shabbos over there explains that it was a clasp. Rashi elsewhere in at the end of Sota, and the Ran over here explains that it means a tiara. So whatever the case, it would be something that had a picture of Yerushalayim on it. So basically he's saying, like this, instead of the straw stuck in your hair, halavai, I had something like that to be able to put on your hair. Also, Eliyahu idmi lahoim ke'insha. Eliyahu Anavi came and disguised himself as a person to come and show them basically that there are other people who have it even worse off than them, and to help raise their spirits. The Kokori Abava, he's calling at the door, asking to be let in. Omalahu, he tells them, Hovali Purta de Tivna, please give me a little straw, de Elidas Itasoi, because my wife has given birth, Velesnami Dam La Agnuya, and I don't have anything for her to lie on. I don't even have any straw for her to lie on. Omalah Rabbi Akiva Leinsei, so Rabbi Akiva says to his wife, to Rochel, Chazoi, Hai Gavra, look at this guy, Dafi Lativna Leislei, he doesn't even have straw. So as poor as we are, we should realize there are other people who are even worse off than us. You know, you have like the expression in Hayyem Yen, in a couple of places, that when it comes to Gashmiistic matters, always look at those who are further down than you and given and thank the Eibishter that you're not in that situation. Whereas when it comes to things, Beruchnius, you want to look at those who are higher than you and aspire to be like them. So this way, Eliyahu Anavi coming helped raise their spirits and realize that as much Mesiras Nefesh as they're having for Torah, there are other people who have it even worse. Omrele, she says to him, Zilhavi Bebe Rab, go learn in the yeshiva. And as we talked about in Ksubas, he had to start from the beginning. He had to learn in Cheder. Here and also in Ksubas, the Gemara doesn't give all the details. In Avastid Abnasan, it gives even more detail. He went with his son to Cheder. We talked about when we learned this in Ksubas that actually it seems Rabbi Akiva had previously been married and had a son. Tosfos mentions in a couple of places that son may be identical with Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha, so they originally went to Cheder to learn together. You have a whole story that I've told here before that's found in one medrash that Rabbi Akiva was embarrassed of learning in Cheder and his wife had to do a whole thing involving their donkey and dirt on it and whatever, and you have a whole thing also with him seeing the famous story we all learn as kids about the rock and the water. So different things that all motivated him to actually go and learn enough to be able to actually go and learn in yeshiva. Also have a tarte situation in Kamei Rabbi Yezer of Yeshua. He went and learned for 12 years straight by Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua. Lemishlam Tauti Sreishnin, when 12 years had passed, come, which we learned in Ksubas, that was often a normal time that Chachamim would go away to learn. We talked about that and a couple of reasons why 12, Marsha, etc. There normally a man would get married at 18, Ben Shmoneh Esrei L'Chuppah, and he'd learn in the yeshiva straight for 12 years until Ben Shloshim L'Koyach. Here, Rabbi Akiva is much older than that. He started out at 40, but we talked about over there also different other reasons why they would often go for 12 years. In any case, that's how long he went for. At the end of 12 years, Kamba also the base, then he came, he got up and was heading home. And we learned in Ksubas that by that point already, he had 12,000 Talmidim accompanying him. He overhears from behind his house that a certain Russia is saying the following to his wife. Now, when we learned this in Ksubas, the version that the Gemara had there, it wasn't Chad Russia, it was just a certain person. There was just a certain person over there. Shami Lahu Sava was the expression, an old man over there. So here, the Gemara is identifying him as he was a Russia. He says, Shapir Ovid Lachavuch, you know what? Your father, Talba Savua, did a good thing by disinheriting you. Chodid Lajamilich, number one, your husband, Akiva, is nothing like you. In many ways, she came from a rich family. He was poor. She came from a family of great yichus. There's some place in Gemara that traces the family of Kalba Savua. I think it says the Yerushalmi that says they were descended from Kolev. Was Rabbi Akiva as a Ben Gerim? There's a number of them. He was an Amoret. They were a family of Tamar Chachamim. So in many ways, he's not like you. He's left you with a living widow all these years. What's this? He was with you, and then he left. In 12 years, you're muching zich by yourself. So she tells him, Iminai dilit sayis, you know what, if you would listen to me, lehevi tauti suren sure shnin achrina, then he would go away, taka, for another 12 years. Sure enough, also, so he did, he left, so sure enough, Omar, so Rabbi Akiva says to himself, Hoyo v'yahavat li rishusa, since she's given me rishus, then I'll turn around and go back to the yeshiva. And sure enough, he was in the yeshiva for another 12 years. We talked about then something that Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, one of the famous Balei Amusar, says he didn't even go in to say hello to her because that would be a break in his learning. And he knew that he has the capability, 24 years straight, where he'll be able to accomplish so much more than 2 times 12 years. It's not the same thing, so therefore he realized it's important to not even take that break in between, and if she's giving him permission, it means that he has the capability now of learning 24 years straight, and therefore he's going to do that. So sure enough, he went back, so sure enough, he was in the yeshiva for another 12 years. When we learned about this in Ksubas, I mentioned also something that the Yerushalmi in Tzachim says about it, that it was 13 years that he was learning by Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua before he even ever asked a question in the Beis Medrash. All that time, he's soaking up learning, and there's Gemaras and Midrashim elsewhere that says that he would soak up everything, and then he'd go and logically arrange it in his mind. But all that time, he had never asked anything, and Rabbi Eliezer, therefore, didn't think much of him. What kind of a Talmud is this who never asks? Then came 13 years, 1 year after he came back here the second time, and he asked an Eisen and Akasha, and all of a sudden, Rabbi Eliezer realized who he's dealing with. He came back with 24,000 pairs of Talmidim. Now, 24,000 pairs would be 48,000 Talmidim. The other Gemara, the Gemara in Ksubas, actually has it that there was 24,000 Talmidim. So in one place it says 24,000, in another place it says 12,000 pairs. So Mistama, the Girsa over here, is probably a blend of those two, and it means to say either it was supposed to say 12,000 pairs or 24,000. Whatever the case, he had 24,000 students, as we famously know. So he said he came back with the 24,000 students. Nothing. Kula Almala Ape, everybody came out to greet him. Choshev Atamon Chocham is coming to town. The Afi Kadma Slame Paklape, she was also getting ready to go and out and see him. Now, whether did she know that it's her husband, Rabbi Akiva, coming back, or did she not, there are different Mephoreshim about that. The Mephoresh over here that's printed under Rashi's name brings 2 possibilities. One possibility is she knows that it's Rabbi Akiva coming. The other is she doesn't, but it's a distinguished Talmud Chacham coming to town, and she's also going to go out to greet him. Omala Hai Rashia, the same Rosha says to her, Va'at Lahechan Azlat, where do you think you're going? Now, the version that we had in Ksubas, it wasn't a Rosha, it was her neighbors telling her you don't really have proper clothing for the purpose. But here, apparently, the Gemara is understanding that it was a Rosha who was trying to dissuade her from going out and having the schus of being Makabal Ponim Atamat Chacham. Amrelay, she answers him with an expression of a pasuk, Yedei Tzadik Din Dalim, the Tzadik knows the judgment of the poor, meaning in other words, he's not going to look down on me because I'm poor. So if it was that she knows this is Rabbi Akiva, she's saying that she's not going to look down on me, his wife, even though I'm dressed very poorly. And if she didn't know that's Rabbi Akiva, she's saying also a Tzadik doesn't look down on poor people like that just because they're dressed shabbily. Or the Girsa in the printed Gemara is Yedei Tzadik Nefesh Behemtoi. She quotes the Pasuk, which we also have in Ksubas, that she says the Tzadik knows the soul of an animal. So in other words, even a Tzadik, even for an animal, he has Rachmanis on it. He knows how much effort he puts in. The same way, in other words, he'll have Rachmanis on me. He's not going to look down on me because he's not going to look down on me. Adrab Marsha points out that he knows that I don't have any choshev clothing, and he actually promised me. In fact, Marsha says an interesting thing. We just said that Yerushalayim Shel Zahav, Rashi and Shabbos translate to Yerushalayim Shel Zahav that he had said to her many years earlier that he would give her is actually a clasp. Now again, according to many of the Mefoshim, that it goes on the head, it's a tiara. But according to Rashi and Shabbos, it's a clasp that goes on the front of the clothing. Well, that kind of thing sometimes is called a nefesh. In Masechta Kelim, I think it mentions that a clasp or a pin like that that goes on the front of the clothing, that goes on the front of the blouse or the dress to hold it closed, is called a beis hanefesh. Actually, you have a pasuk in Yeshaya that mentions Botei HaNefesh, and Rashi there explains it means something like that, a clasp that goes on the place of the Nefesh on the chest. So therefore she's saying he knows the nefesh of Behemtoi, that he knows, in other words, he promised me that Nefesh all those years ago, and I know that he's going to eventually fulfill it. There's a place in Lakurta Torah, actually, the Altadeva makes mention of the fact that, why is she using a pasuk involving a behemah? The Altadeva makes mention of the fact you have neshamas from Zoh, and you have neshamas from Malchus, which is compared to a behemah. Behemah b'gematria ban, as in neshamas to ban, so therefore that's why she's using specifically this pasuk. Anyway, the point is she's saying he's not going to look down on me. So sure enough, she came to appear before him. And the Talmidim are pushing her away. They have no idea who she is. Rabbi Akiva tells them, leave her alone. All of my Torah and all of your Torah is all because of her, because she's the one who convinced me in the first place to go learn Torah. We talked about when we learned this in Ksubas that everyone's pointed out in a sicha when we get down to it, the entire Torah Shebaal Peh, all of the collections that we have of Torah Shebaal Peh, the Mishnayos, Sifra, Sifri, etc., all of them come from Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva. So in that sense, really, we have the entire Torah Shebaal Peh. Torah Simecha stands on the shoulders of this one woman, Rochel, the wife of Rabbi Akiva. Shoma Avua, her father heard that a Talmid Chacham had come to town, and he figured out as we learned in Ksubas, eventually Rabbi Akiva told him, "This is me, that I'm your son-in-law." The Itchalan Nedre, so Kalvus Avua was Matu Neder. The Ishtari Minichse, and now Rabbi Akiva is able to have Hanah from his Nechassim. The Ran deals with over here. We talked about in Ksubas how exactly that could work. Isn't it a matter of Noilud? And we talked about a couple of different answers over there. One of them, the Ran brings over here, that Kalva Savor had made the Neder if he doesn't learn any Torah at all. But there was a high likelihood that if he's going to the Beis Medrash, he's going to at least learn something. So therefore, it means that it's not Noilud, it's something expectable. Tosfos, in fact, in Ksubas says even more so. If he goes to the Beis Medrash, for sure he's going to become a Talmud Chacham. He's going to actually not just one halacha, but he's going to know lots of halachas. So therefore, it's not considered Noilud. It's not considered something completely out of left field like that. When Rabbi Akiva became rich, now we're going to go on to say various sources that Rabbi Akiva became wealthy from. In fact, he did fulfill the promise to Rachel, and he did get her a Yerushalayim Shel Zahav. The Yerushalmi even tells about it in Shabbos, where it talks about this Yerushal Zahav ornament, that Rabbi Gamliel's wife was a little jealous of it, and she said to Rabbi Gamliel, "Why don't you buy me one?" And Rabbi Gamliel tells her, "You know what? I want you to know something. Rachel, actually, during all those lean years when Rabbi Akiva was away, and he's Okay, he's doing some kind of work. He's selling wood. It mentions, I think, in Ovester of Nossen, he was chopping wood and sending whatever money he could home from that. But still, she actually sold her hair for people to use for wigs or other purposes like that. So Don Gamil says to his wife, did you ever do that? She had a much greater Mesiris Nefesh than you ever did for Torah, and therefore she deserves this ornament in a way that you don't. Interestingly, Ben Yehoyada points out over here that the expression that he said at the beginning, he says, if I had Remina Loch Yerushalayim the Dava. Remina literally means I would place you. Now, what do you mean I would place you? I'd give it to you. So he explains that actually we find an Ovestid of Nosson at the end of the story that Rabbi Akiva's Talmidim say to him when he gives her the Yerushalayim Shel Zahav, they tell her, you're embarrassing us. And he tells her, look how much Mesiris Nefesh she had for Torah. So Ben Yehoyada learns, it wasn't, why would they say you're embarrassing us? So he explains that actually Rabbi Akiva meant, not just I'll give it to you and you'll put it on yourself. I'll help attach it, I'll tie it on to your head, and therefore the Talmidim are saying, it doesn't seem right that you, the great Talmud Chacham, the great leader of the Jewish people, should be personally putting ornaments on your wife, and Rabbi Akiva tells them she deserves it for everything that she went through to make it possible for me to learn Torah. So the Gemara goes on. Min shis mili i'ata Rabbi Akiva. There are actually six different sources from which Rabbi Akiva became wealthy. Now, why is this important to know? Marsha points out the importance of it is we shouldn't think, well, he had 24,000 under him. He charged them tuition, and he became rich from that. No, as we learned earlier in this Masechta, you're not allowed to be paid for teaching Torah Sheval Peh. So we have to be told that he became wealthy in other ways. Why Dr. Six, a number of different Mephoshim give different reasons. Ion Yaakov mentions a point that he put in tremendous idea in Torah Sheval Peh, and therefore into the six Zorim, and therefore he has six sources. And there's a number of different interesting explanations. One of them being that we know that Rabbi Akiva darshaned every letter and every word in the Torah, including even the extra vavs. You would think sometimes a vav is just there stylistically. You actually have in Rashi, in today's Chumash, the Eis Kalasha Atzava Oischol B'nei Yisrael, that this is a vav Yisero Tfela. Nevertheless, Rabbi Akiva would darshan even such vavs, and therefore, for that, he deserves to have six sources of wealth. A number of other explanations that different Mephoshim give why Dafka six. Anyway, number one has been Min Bar Kalva Savua. Number one, we just said that Kalva Savua gave him some of his wealth. And in Ksubas, we learned that he gave him half his wealth. The second one is umin ayala dispinta. The second one is from the deer or the gazelle of a ship, meaning the chol spinta avdin lo chad min ona umin ena. A ship in those days they would make at the front of the ship. At the front of the ship, they would make a hollow image of a deer or a gazelle or some creature like that. Ila ayala means a gazelle. Honor would be a sheep, so it can mean like something from the greater sheep family, which includes goats. So whatever the case, these are animals that run very fast. It was meant as like a good simon, so that the ship should travel as fast in the water as a gazelle or a goat or whatever does on land. And usually they would keep the ship's treasury inside that hood ornament. So it was kind of like a hood ornament on a car, sort of. So they would keep the ship's treasury inside that. One time they forgot it and they left it on the seashore when they were loading up the ship. They left that gazelle shaped thing on the seashore. Also, Huashkeche and Rabbi Akiva came and found it. The Shittim Kubetzis actually brings a version of the story. That what happened was, these were merchants, these were Goyish merchants who were transporting a cargo of pearls and precious stones and things like that. And then, so as they were busy with their, it's expensive merchandise, they're busy seeing to it that it's getting loaded on the ship and taken care of properly, and therefore they left this thing on the seashore. So Rabbi Akiva by the dock. So Rabbi Akiva finds it. Now, they weren't going to give up on it so easily. Of course, it's got the whole ship's treasury in it. So they started advertising that we lost this thing, whoever found it. So Rabbi Akiva comes forward and tells them, I found it. They were so impressed with his honesty that they told him, you can keep it. So that was the second thing. The third one is Umin Gavza. The third one is that he became rich from a Gavza. Now, the Ran understands that Gavza is related to a word in Aramaic that means a treasury. So it's also a treasury, from a boat, but a different kind, as we're going to talk about. The Rosh explains, rather, that Gavza means a block of wood, like a stump of a tree. Anyway, what happened was, one time Rabbi Akiva gave 4 zuzim to some sailors. He tells them, go find something that you can buy with 4 zuzim. We often find 4 zuzim the Gemara uses to mean like a small amount of money. It would be approximately the amount that a simple laborer could earn in one day. So the Rabbi Akiva is asking the sailors to bring him back some kind of souvenir or something that they could buy for the 4 zuzim. The only thing they found was this gavza by the seashore. So again, either a gavza is a treasure box, like a chest, or according to the Ran, or a block of wood according to the Rosh. I see it, like, they brought it to him. Omrule, they told him, Ye'ebed Morona Ale. Rebbe, let him do something with this. So the Mefarish explains it means basically, this is all we have right now. We couldn't find anything better, but Rebbe, please take this and you'll have it for the time being until we can find something better with your 4 zuzim. Marsha has a different explanation of that one, Marsha has a different explanation of Yevid Marana Ale. They tell him, this is like the Rosh says, it's a block of wood. So they tell him, Rabbi Akiva, we don't know what you can do with a block of wood, but at least, for example, if you need to chop something on it, you can use this block of wood as a stand, as an anvil, to chop things on. It turned out to be full of gold coins. So if it was a chest and he opened it up and found it was full of gold coins, or if you say it was a block of wood, then the point is, Marsha says, like he was using it as a chopping block, and then as he was chopping, he split it open and gold coins came pouring out. What was gold doing in there in the first place? One time a ship sank. All of the money of the ship was in that gavza. So either, again, it was a chest, which is a normal place to keep money, or if it means that it was a block of wood or a stump, it means they wanted to conceal the money in there so nobody makes off with it. And then they found that time that it came from Das Rukisa. So what does Das Rukisa mean? Marsha points out, none of the Mefarshim here, neither the Ran, nor the Rosh, nor the Mefarsh, explain what Das Rukisa is. And in fact, the Hagoyes HaBach puts it a little earlier, Tova Svinta Demin Das Rukisa. So he explains that Das Rukisa means that it was from Yishma'elim, it was from Arab merchants. We find in a couple of places in the literature of Chazal that the Arabs are called Srikiyim or Srukisa or something like that. And in older English, they used to sometimes call the Arabs the Saracens, so it's the same Shodesh, the same word, basically. It was the name of an Arab tribe or something. So Mindistrukisa would mean that this ship belonged to Arab merchants. So apparently the idea was, before we said they would keep the ship's treasury inside the Ayala, that was probably Greek or Roman sailors would do that, as opposed to apparently the Arab sailors would do it differently. They would put it inside a chest or inside a block of wood, and here, when their ship sank, then it washed up on the dry land and Rabbi Akiva found it. Ben Yoyoda, by the way, makes the point. I mean, first of all, obviously the sailors are definitely going Lefnim Meshuras Adin over here, but that they didn't keep it for themselves. The Gemara does mention at the end of Ksubas, Hasaponim Ruben Chasidim, most sailors are Chasidim because they're constantly in danger on the water and they're constantly davening to the Eveshah to save them. So therefore, even Goyisha ones, okay, they're davening to their Getshkas, but whatever. The point is, so they tend to be very honest, tight people. But you have to ask, says Ben Yoyoda, practically speaking, they picked up this thing, didn't they feel that it's heavy? Didn't they realize there's something in it, that they're bringing it to Rabbi Akiva and saying, well, we don't have anything better, but take this for the time being. So he explains that the walls of it were made out of metal. So the fact that it was heavy, they figured it's heavy because it's made out of metal. They didn't realize that it's also full of gold coins. So far we've got 3 sources of Rabbi Akiva's wealth. The next one is Umin Matrunisa. The next one is from a Roman noblewoman. So all 3 of them, the Mefarshim tell the story over here that one time Rabbi Akiva needed to borrow some money for Tzorchei Tzibur or for his yeshiva or whatever it is. He goes to a goyish and noble woman. He asks her to lend him the money. She says, she lived by the seashore. She lived, I guess, on the coast of Eretz Yisrael. So she tells him, I want your God and the sea to be a raven for the loan. So Okay? Then when it came time to pay back the loan, Rabbi Akiva didn't show up. The Rosh explains that he had fallen ill. So she needs the money, so she goes and starts davening to Hashem, and she says, you know, listen, I understand, I'm sure Rabbi Akiva didn't come, he must have a good reason, such as he's sick, but after all, that's then you have to be the Ariv. And so then all of a sudden, Abishta causes the emperor's daughter in Rome, hundreds of miles away, all of a sudden goes crazy and goes into her father's treasury, takes a huge chest full of gold and diamonds and what have you, and throws it into the sea. Into the Mediterranean, and the Abishta makes the waves carry it from place to place until it falls. It comes up on the seashore right in front of her feet. And she opens it up, and sure enough, there's money in there, even more than what she had lent Rabbi Akiva. Later, Rabbi Akiva comes to pay her, and he apologizes. I wasn't feeling well. She tells him that the guarantors came through, the Abishta and the sea came through, and then she says to him, keep the money that you brought me and use it for your tum and use it for yourself and your Talmidim. So that was the fourth source of Rabbi Akiva's wealth. The fifth one is Umin Ishrei Shel Turnus Rufus. Then you have the wife of Turnus Rufus. So again, the older Mephoshim over here tell the story. Turnus Rufus, we have in many places in Shas and the Drashim that he would debate Rabbi Akiva. He would try to prove in his own goy with his own goyish way against things in Torah. And Rabbi Akiva would always best him in arguments and show that he doesn't know what he's talking about. Sometimes these arguments would even take place in front of the emperor, and therefore this Turnus Rufus would get horribly embarrassed that Rabbi Akiva showed him up every time. So one day he comes home in a bad mood. His wife asks him, what's up? He tells her, I can't stand it anymore. So she tells him, you know what, I have an idea. We know that the Jewish God hates immorality. So then we have to get him that he won't be in Hashem's good graces anymore. I'll go with your permission and try to seduce him. So she does. The Mephoresh says she comes to him. She dresses herself up nicely. She comes to him. The Mephoresh adds the detail. She uncovers her leg. And Rabbi Akiva laughs and cries and spits. Now, what's all that about? He tells her, I'm spitting because you came from Tipas Rucha, as much as you're beautiful now, but look what a disgusting thing you came from originally, from a putrid drop of Zera. So you have a similar in Pirkei Avos, but yeah, here he tells her a little differently. Why am I crying? Because this beauty of yours is going to rot away in the ground. Why am I laughing? He didn't want to tell her. So the Mephoresh says she actually wormed the secret out of him. All the other Mephoreshim, the Ran and the Rosh, when they tell the story, they don't have this detail. But in any case, what it was is he knew Baruch HaKodesh that eventually he's going to marry her. So she asks him, is it possible? She realizes, obviously, she hasn't gotten anywhere with him. She asks him, is it possible for someone like me to do tshuva? And he tells her, yeah. So the upshot of it is when Turnus, so the Mephoresh adds the detail that after Turnus Rufus died, everybody else just says she married. She eventually became a Geordis and married her. The Mephoresh adds the detail after Turnus Rufus died, which is an interesting point, by the way, because we find that Turnus Rufus was the Roman official who oversaw Rabbi Akiva's execution. So in that case, then how could he be dead before Rabbi Akiva marries his wife, before his wife becomes a Geordis and Rabbi Akiva marries him? So there are actually some of the Mephoreshim who want to say that maybe what it says in the Mephoresh is not correct. Maybe while they were alive, he divorced her and she went and married Rabbi Akiva, and maybe that's even part of what he had against Rabbi Akiva, is that here his own wife ends up becoming Rabbi Akiva's wife. On the other hand, Dodas sort of shown him points out on various grounds that's less logical to say. And the fact is, the Mephoresh is saying, whether it's Rashi or whether it's another Rishon, says that it was after Turnus Rufus died, and we can't just ignore that. So he says, evidently, there were two Turnus Rufuses. Based on history books from that time, it's very possible. Actually, Ben Yehoyada says a little differently. He says maybe Turnus Rufus was like a general name, the same way as you have like Tarai for all the kings of Mitzrayim and Abimelech for all the kings of Plishtim. Maybe Turnus Rufus was like the official name for all the governors of all the Roman governors of Eretz Yisrael. Whatever the case, she had tremendous wealth and she brought it into the marriage, and that's the fifth source from which Rabbi Akiva got his wealth. And the sixth one, Umin Ketir Bar Shalom. And we find, by the way, elsewhere in the Gemara, we find that her name was Rufina. The Romans had a system with last names where the wife's name was similar to her husband's name, but a feminine form of it. One of the stories the Medrash tells involving Turnus Rufus and Rabbi Akiva is Turnus Rufus, and he asks Rabbi Akiva, you say that Hashem is a Kael Kana, that he's jealous of the fact that people are worshipping Avodah Zarah. Why? If you say Avodah Zarah is worthless anyway, why should he care about it? So Rabbi Akiva tells him, I'll tell you the answer tomorrow. The next day, Turnus through. The next day, Rabbi Akiva and Turnus through Rufus meet up. And Rabbi Akiva tells him, last night I had a dream. I had two dogs, and I named one of them Rufus and the other one Rufina. Like you and your wife's name. And the guy starts getting angry. What a chutzpah. You're naming dogs after me and my wife. And Rabbi Akiva tells him, think about it. You know, you're both Nivroyim. You both have bodies. You both go to the bathroom the same way. You both a lot of things. And yet you're insulted that I call dogs by your name. Allah has kama v'kama. The Eibush should be very insulted that people are calling Getchkes by his name. So we see that her name was Rufina. Anyway, so that's the fifth one. And then the sixth one, Omin Ketia Bar Sholem. The story of Ketia Bar Sholem is in the Gemara Avodah Zarah. There was a Roman emperor who wanted to destroy the Jewish people, Rahman al-Flan. So he asks, he tells his advisors, he gives them a mashal, if a person has a dead flesh on his foot, should he leave it and continue to suffer, or should he cut it off and he'll live? In other words, he means to compare the Jewish people to like an irritating growth on the foot. Rabbi Levi Yitzchok, by the way, that Eva's father has a fascinating explanation of it, that we find that Yaakov is holding on to Esav's heel. That's why this emperor is after using this metaphor of something stuck to the foot. And he has a whole explanation over there about different details in the story over there. Anyway, so one of the advisors or senators or whatever it is, tells the emperor, there's two reasons why you wouldn't be successful. Number one, the Jewish people are scattered all over the world, and they're like the winds of the world. The world needs winds in the same way that the world needs the Jewish people. And second of all, he tells them, if you try to destroy them within your kingdom, then within your empire, all it is people are going to call you a Malchusik Tia, a cut off kingdom. Like all you did is you tried to do genocide, but you weren't successful in wiping them all out anyway. Kitzur Amaisa, the emperor sentences him to death. He makes himself a bris milah right before he dies. This way he earns himself a place in Olam Haba. And just before he dies, he's given the name Ketia Bar Sholem, the Gemara calls him. And right before he died, he says, Kol nechosai v'Rabbi Akiva v'chaverim. All my nechosim should go to Rabbi Akiva and his chaverim. And Rabbi Akiva understood that to mean, and that it means half of it goes to Rabbi Akiva and half to the other chachamim in aggregate. So that was the sixth source from which Rabbi Akiva got his wealth. Since we're talking about Rabbi Akiva getting a treasure like that unexpectedly, one of his six things was that the sailors brought him an unexpected treasure. So now the Gemara gives another example like that. Rav Gamda, Yoav Dalad Zuzim Sfunoi. Rav Gamda one time did the same kind of thing. He gave four zuzim to some sailors, Lasuya behind Midam, to bring him something that they could buy with the four zuz. Loy Ashkochu, they couldn't find anything. Isulay behind Koifa, so they brought him for the four zuz, they brought him a monkey. Ishtemit, the monkey ran away from them. Ayalachosa, and went into a hole, or a cave in the ground. Chofru Basre, the sailors are digging to find the monkey and catch it. Ashkochu, Diravial Magalaisa, they saw that it was crouching and lying on a pile of jewels. I see like Kulin, and they brought all the jewels to Rav Gamda. So he invested four zuzim, and he got a much greater return for it. Ion Yaakov points out another reason why the Gemara mentions this point is, after all, you're going to ask in the case of Rabbi Akiva with the Gavza over there, is it really right that the sailors brought him what they thought was stam a chest or stam a block of wood, and he's keeping all of it for himself? But we see that saponim, again, we see saponim, ruben chassidim, that the sailors tend to be chassidim and go to finimishur chassidim like that, and therefore Rabbi Akiva was able to take it, and the same way Rav Gamda is able to take it. So we said, like this, Marsha points out, after all, he hadn't even made a kinyan on the monkey yet. And yet they went to finimishur chassidim and brought him not only the monkey, but all the diamonds or whatever that it was resting on. With that said, there's an interesting point that the famous Lomdash Sefer, the Marcheshes, makes a point. That the Marcheshes was the co-rov of Vilna in the years before World War II. So he explains that based on a relevant Gemara in Ksubas, that actually Mitzad Adin Rav Gamda would be entitled to half the jewels. They went Lefnei Mishur HaSadin and gave him all of it. Going back to, though, we were talking about Chachamim who were not so, who were poor and otherwise had difficulties in life. So now the Gemara tells a story over here, which we also have in the Sechta Tainis. Omer le bas kesa le Rabbi Shlomo ben Chananya. The daughter of the Roman emperor says to Rabbi Shlomo ben Chananya, Chochma or Torah b'fuara b'kli mechur. How comes it that such a beautiful Torah of yours is in an ugly vessel? Because Rabbi Yeshua was dark. Some say it could be he was naturally dark skinned. Some of the Mephoshim point out there's Gemaras in other places that mention that he fasted a lot. In particular, there's one time when he said something that was slightly disrespectful against Beis Shammai, and it says over there, Hushchurushinov, Mepnei Atzoimus, his teeth turned black from fasting. We also find in the Gemara Brachas, he worked as a blacksmith. He was making and selling needles. So whatever the case, he wasn't very physically attractive. So she's saying, how could that be? Such a glorious Torah in such an ugly vessel. Omalah, so he answers her, Loi lamad mi beis avich, haven't you learned from your father's household, from the emperor's palace, b'mam machsin yayin, where do they put wine in? Omrele, she tells him, b'moni de pachra, they put it in earthenware utensils. Amalah, so he tells her, Kula alma b'moni de pachra. Sure, everybody else puts them in earthenware utensils. Ma'atun b'moni de pachra. Is it right that you, the emperor's household, should also be having them in plain earthenware kelim like that? Atun achisu b'moni de chasper v'dava. You should be putting your wine in gold and silver containers. So obviously he meant it to tell her the same way, as it doesn't work like that, the same way it doesn't work for Torah to necessarily be in an attractive vessel, but she took him at face value. So she sure enough went and put the wine in gold and silver utensils. And it went sour because the wine reacts with the metals. So now he explains to her, after Isaacane, it's the same thing with the Torah. So the version of the story in Tainus has that the emperor found out about it. He's very angry, and she why'd you do that? And she says, well, Rabbi Yeshua told me to do that. So he calls in Rabbi Yeshua, and Rabbi Yeshua explains to him that it was meant as a mushal and as a nimshal. Omrele, so she tells him, Va'ika Shapiri Ugmiri. The fact is, though, there are people who are attractive and they're learned in Torah. Omrele, so he tells her, Ihavu Sanai and Havu Gmirin Tvei. Yes, but if they were unattractive, they might be much more learned. Now, Sanayin on the face of it means that if they are ugly, and that's how the Ran explains it. On the other hand, Tosfos in Tainus points out the fact is that we do see there are very handsome people who are also great Talmid Chachamim. So Tosfos explains over there, Ihavu Sanayin means if they consider the whole concept of physical beauty to be unimportant and to be unimportant to them. So not that they themselves are unattractive. But they sonim ayofi is how Tosfos explains it. If they hate the beauty, in other words, they don't care whether they don't care beauty or not. So then it means then they would be more learned, as opposed to if they pay attention to their appearance, then less so. Marsha points out, you know, the fact is we do find the Gemara mentions in this connection in Tainus that Torah stays only by a person who is humble. So Bederach HaTeva, a person who is not so attractive, is going to be more humble. Following Tosfos' logic is that if they don't consider beauty to be an important thing, then it means even if they are physically handsome, they're not holding themselves higher because of it, and then Torah can stay by them. But Al-Bakhla makes a point over here that that Torah is something higher than Gashmias, and therefore that's why it tends to be more other things being equal by people who have less Gashmias, as in poor people and unattractive people. So in this connection, another story about a great Talmid Chacham who was physically unattractive. A woman once came from the city of Nahuda to Rabbi Yehuda for Din Torah. Rabbi Yehuda was the Rosh Hashiva in Pompadisa. The Ischaivus Mindina, and she was found guilty in the Din Torah, and she has to pay. Omer Olay, she says to him, Shmuel Rabba Hochi Donan, do you think your Rebbe Shmuel would have judged me this way? This is how the Mephoresh explains that she's asking Bithmiya that you judge me guilty. Do you think your Rebbe Shmuel would have judged me that way? On the other hand, Marsha says that it means v'nichusa. She's saying as a statement, you know, years back I had a case like this involving your Rebbe Shmuel that was in front of your Rebbe Shmuel, and he also judged the same way. Omer Olay, so he asks, you died today? Did you know him? You're from Nauda. Did you knew him in person? Omer Olay Ein, she says, yes, and I can describe him. Gutza, he was short, the Rabba Kresi, and he had a big stomach. Ucham, he was dark skinned, the Rabba Shine, and had big teeth. You get down to it, you know, this is, I think we can probably fairly say that Shmuel, therefore, because of this Gemara, is the only Tana or Amora where we can reasonably say that we have some idea of his appearance. But in any case, Amalah, Rabbi Yehuda says, Levazuria Kaosis, you came to mock him? What are you describing him like that? You could have said that you knew him without giving this unflattering description. Teheviya, he insta b'shamta, that woman, meaning you, should be in Shamta, which is a form of Chayim. So she still didn't ask Mechila or anything like that. Tokas, so she bursts open, Umisa, and she died as a result of the Chayim, because, like this, she should have at least thought to ask Mechila. The Mordechai, in fact, learns from this, and this is brought lahalacha. Now, you could say, she's just giving a description. What do you want from her? But the fact is, we see from that when the Chocham, in this case, Rabbi Yehuda, has good reason to think that she's doing it in order to mock him, then he's entitled to put her in Chedim for that reason, even though you could be Malamed Schust on her and say that she was saying it for a different reason. Yom Yom Mashiach Ugo'ola. The pasuk says about Mashiach in Kapitel Ayin Beis, which on the face of it is about Shlomo, but a lot of it talks about Mashiach, as we learned at the end of Ksubas, and as we learned here in Nedarim, there are various psukim in it that refer to Mashiach. So the pasuk says V'yered miyom ad yom, he'll rule from sea to sea, or minoha ad af se'aretz, and from the river until the ends of the world. So from the river to the sea, as the anti-Semites are saying nowadays, but the opposite, Mashiach will be ruling. Now, Rashi in Parshas Balak explains that this pasuk is referring to Melech HaMashiach. Zechariah also speaks more explicitly about Mashiach. He also uses the expression, Moshlim yom ad yom, or minar ad apse oretz. And the Rambam also brings this point that when Bilam says in his Nevuah, of a character called B'nai Sheis, that he'll dominate and destroy all the B'nai Sheis, is Melech HaMashiach, because he'll rule from one ocean to the next. So, B'Pashtos, that means that Melech HaMashiach will be ruling and dominating the entire world. As in fact, the Eben Ezra says, the sea to sea over here, Taka, doesn't mean just from the Mediterranean to the Dead Sea or whatever. It means, and he explains, it means from the Red Sea all the way to the ocean, and from Menahar, from the rivers that come from Aden, which is in the extreme east, all the way to Afse Oretz, to the extreme west. So basically the whole known world, which in the Eben Ezra's times was only the three continents of Asia, Africa, and Europe, and nowadays is the entire stack of the entire world. Continuing on halachas, we started talking yesterday about the concept of eros chatzeres. If you have two chatzeres, have a door between them. So if they want, each chotzer can make a separate eruv, and then they can each carry in their chotzer, but they wouldn't be able to carry from one chotzer to another anything that was in the house when Shabbos began. They would be able to carry from one chotzer to another, by the way, things that were in one chotzer before Shabbos, but not even if they didn't make an Eruv in common between them. But if they want, instead, since they have a doorway between them, then they can make one big Eruv across both chotzeres, and then they can carry from one chotzer to another without restrictions. If you have just a window between them, and the window is 4x4 tefachim, and at least part of the window is within 10 tefachim, and there's nothing blocking the window, like a screen or anything like that, then also that's a valid thing that can make an Eruv in common. Anything less than that, if it's less than 4x4, if none of it is within 10 tefachim of the ground, or if it has a screen or whatever, then they can't. As far as if it's between two houses, then they could, even if it's above 10 tefachim, because a house in halacha, technically a house, is considered as though it's filled up all the way to the ceiling, meaning in other words, because it has a roof, then it's different than a chotzer, which is open to the air. So if the window has a screen in it, then still not, but if it, as long as the window is there, then it's still considered they can make an eruv in common.